Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
Hey, guys, look! It's the real Buzz Lightyear!
You're mocking me, aren't you?
Oh, no, 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 no. Buzz, look, an alien!
Where?
Bye!
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Hi, folks. I'm Lynn. I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone. And I'm here with my wonderful co-hosts, Bobby Neer, Robert, and Dave.
Hello.
Hello.
As Rod would say, we have clues to today's show. What could those clues be?
Oh, I really love that.
See, Lynn just likes to stop and listen to the music, so.
Yes. And I want to welcome everyone who's here today. We've got Bear Fan Ron. Hi, Ron. Happy Saturday to you, too. And, of course, we have Rick Wall. And we have Ed. Ed will be here shortly. And we have, of course, my wonderful co-host, Bobby Neer, and Dave, and Robert. And that's like
he is marvelous. Simply marvelous.
Marvelous. Marvelous.
You are marvelous, Bobby. Simply marvelous.
Today, we have one of the Twilight Zone's most memorable episodes up for discussion. It's called Five Characters in Search of an Exit. And Robert, my dear, please provide the opening clip for that.
I certainly will.
And now, Mr. Serling.
Clown. Hobo. Ballet dancer. Bagpiper. And an army major. A collection of question marks. Five improbable entities stuck together into a pit of darkness. No logic, no reason, no explanation. Just a prolonged nightmare in which fear, loneliness, and the unexplainable walk hand in hand through the shadows. In a moment, we'll start collecting clues as to the whys, the whats, and the wheres. We will not end the nightmare, we'll only explain it. Because this is the Twilight Zone.
Thank you, Robert. We appreciate
that.
Yes. Well, an army major in uniform. He wakes up and he finds himself trapped inside a large metal cylinder where he meets a clown who introduces him to the others who happen to be a hobo and a ballet dancer and a bagpiper. But none of them has any memory of who they are or how they became trapped in that cylinder. The major, of course, being the newest arrival, is the most determined to escape from the cylinder. And they all tell him there's no way out except the ceiling, and that's too high to reach. But nonetheless, he investigates and he tries everything he can to find an exit. And the major starts questioning all of the other people, and that reveals that the characters have no need for food, water, and basically they feel nothing in general. They all question where, what, and who they are, but they have no memory, nothing. The ballerina, she informs the major, we're in the darkness. We're nameless things with no memory, no knowledge of what went before, no understanding of what is now, and no knowledge of what will be. So guesses are made about, by all of them, guesses are made by about where they are and why they're there. And I think it was the ballerina. She speculates that they're on another planet or on a spaceship heading towards somewhere. The bagpiper, he wonders if they're all dead. The hobo, he suggests they're all insane and in limbo. And the clown, he claims that they're in a dream. They're all part of a dream. But that's not the answer that the major's looking for, you know. And these questions are all immaterial and unsolvable. So the major then concludes that they are in hell. They are indeed in hell. So eventually he comes up with a plan to escape. He thinks that they should form a tower of people, each person standing on the other person's shoulders. And the plan almost works, but this loud gong sound shakes the cylinder when the five of them are standing on each other, and it sends them tumbling to the ground. So that makes him even more determined, and this time he decides that he's going to use his sword and bits of clothing, and he's going to make a grappling hook, and he's going to get up to the top, he's going to put the sword over the top edge, and he's going to climb up there. And this time he does get to the top, and he does manage to grab onto the edge, and he sits on the edge. Wow, this is great. So as he turns to survey the area surrounding the cylinder, oh, no, he tumbles to the ground. He's gone. He yells, he screams, and then he's gone. So the other characters, they talk about how brave he was, even though they think he was foolish. But the clown then says, well, he may be right. They may be in hell.
In the snow. Someone must have dropped.
Oh, thank you, dear. And just drop that in the barrel over there, will you?
You don't have very many, do you?
Oh, dear, no, not nearly enough. It's for the orphans, you know. But it's early, and we've only just started.
And then the scene cuts to a little girl picking up a doll from the snow, and the doll is dressed as an army major. And this woman is standing out there with a bell, ringing a bell, and she tells the little girl to put the doll back in the barrel with the rest of them. And what is happening is that it is a cylinder that's a Christmas toy collection bin for a child's orphanage, and all characters were nothing more than dolls. So the loud noise that was shaking was the handheld bell, which the woman used to attract donations, and the final shot is of the five characters now seen as dolls with their painted faces and glass eyes, and the ballet dancer, this is like the absolute best part, her hand moves down and rests on top of the major's hand, and you see a tear running down her face. Oh, wow, memorable, memorable episode. Gotta love it. I mean, can and now... Think about it. Can any one of us imagine being in a totally empty room, devoid of any doors, windows, objects? I mean, nothing for more than a day or even a few hours. And if that weren't bad enough, you don't know who you are. You don't remember anything about your past life. And to make matters even worse, you're stuck in that empty void with four other strange characters, and they have no clue who they are either. No one knows why they're there. Nobody knows where they are. And, well, I would think that would be, you know, fairly upsetting. And there's another puzzling aspect as well, and that's the horrible gong that keeps sounding off every now and then. I mean, it's enough to make anyone lose their mind. I mean, you can look up and you see something. Yeah, it looks like it's the sky, but they can't be sure. So it's not a very appealing scenario for anyone, to say the least. But it definitely didn't appeal to the Army Major, and that role was played very well by William Wyndham. I mean, you really felt bad for the guy. I mean, he wanted to get out of there so badly. And he had to deal with that crazy clown. He was, like, totally over the top. And the lethargic hobo, you know, the hobo sitting there, like, you know, he looked like he just wanted to fall asleep. And then you got the ballerina. She's like little Mary Sunshine. And then let me see who else you have. Oh, yeah. And the worst of all, you have the bagpipe player. Now, I've got to admit, I don't know how anyone else feels, but I hate the sound of bagpipes. I can't stand it. I mean, it's probably one of the most horrible sounding instruments in the world, and I've always compared it to the sound of a room full of cats all having their tails stepped on at the same time. So being stuck in, you know, being stuck in an empty room with that bagpipe player for any length of time I would be convinced I was in hell, definitely. And so, you know, the major was right, I think. But, you know, but in his case, you know, it wasn't because of the bagpipe player. It was because there seemed to be no escape, you know, no way of getting
probably
out there.
Probably felt as bad as the dogs barking jingle bells at Christmas time every year.
That's pretty bad.
Woof, woof, woof.
That could be annoying.
Woof,
woof, woof, woof, woof, woof, woof, woof, woof, woof, woof, woof, woof,
woof. They're crazy. Well, but Robert. You now see, I have to disagree with something that you mentioned in your review. You said in your review
obvious
that
you would.
You said in
but
your
go
review
ahead.
Other four characters were just sitting around doing nothing. But you got to now, don't you remember that? You know, they said that they did a lot to try to get out of there when they first got there. They
but
just,
the thing is, we're coming in the tail end of that situation. It did explain, yeah, we tried this, you know, we tried to get out. But the thing is, you're coming in at the time. Yeah, they gave up. So that's why they're not doing nothing. It's not the point that they didn't do anything beforehand. It's at the point of the major being there. You know, the ballerinas dancing and the bagpiper and then
yeah,
the clown
they
throw
up.
Some
they
philosophy
really
out. So, yeah, that's what I meant by my yeah. comment on that. So.
Oh, by the way, I would like to welcome Ed, and I want to welcome Felix. Felix is back. Oh yes, and oh yeah, all
from Joyzy. Hey, Felix.
Joyzy, Felix, and Joyzy. Yeah, and we've got Ed, and all the good people are back here.
Hey
yeah.
guys, how you doing?
Hey.
Ed.
Hey Ed.
How are you?
But anyway, we're good. And anyway, so the thing was, you know, they did try to do some stuff in the beginning, but then they kind of gave up, you know, and they never thought of standing on each other's shoulders. And, you know, it didn't turn out in the first time the way they hoped. But then again, it did work the second time. He did manage to get to the top and he fell over, which was sad. But, you know, at least he tried. And, you know, but and the other thing, I know some people in the past thought that this constituted a Christmas episode, but no, it does not constitute a Christmas episode.
Now, here is another thing where we'll have a situation with that, too, is, okay, let's throw this movie in, and do we consider this? This is another one that's controversial about if it's a Christmas movie or not. Die Hard. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie? Even though the setting is in Christmas.
I never thought of Die Hard as a Christmas movie. No.
I see some people think it is.
Yeah?
I think it is. But
really?
There's others that don't. Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, of all the Christmas settings, I mean, it's all involving a Christmas party that I guess his wife at the time was having, and he's coming in to join her. And also Die Hard 2, you have elements of that as being the next year.
You are talking about, okay, you're talking about Die Hard is in the Bruce Willis movie. Okay. All right.
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't seen him in so long.
Because you think about it,
it does constitute, you don't know it is, because this whole time they're in the cylinder, you know, for the first 20-some minutes or whatever, and then after
you know,
the major falls out, then you know it is, because you hear the bell, you see the decorations, and
you
know, that's why I would consider
it. But you see it for one minute.
But it's set in a Christmas atmosphere, but you don't know that until, like you said, you know,
that's why I don't
the very
consider
end.
It. That's why I don't consider it a Christmas story, because you see the bin for 1 minute. To me, the only two Christmas stories that Rod Serling wrote, or at least with an actual Christmas theme, Night of the Meek, of course. You know, that was definitely Christmas.
Right, definitely.
And Changing of the Guard, because that took place.
Now, see, that one...
But that took place at Christmas time. They were leaving.
Yeah, well, this one did, too.
And remember, but you saw the cylinder for a minute. But in Changing in the Guard, you saw they sang Christmas.
Well, you heard the music.
Again. They were getting off Christmas
break.
Yeah.
But you didn't really see the lighting. You didn't really see the Christmas atmosphere. Well, I mean, that's the last episode of the season anyway. We're going to be talking more about that when we get up there. But, I mean, the whole point is, when do you consider a Christmas show a Christmas show? Does it got to be thoroughly Christmas from start to end?
Well, this originally aired December 22nd, so I mean it was clearly aimed to be a Christmas episode. Whether or not you want to call it one, that's kind of subjective. I don't know.
I think you need to see more references to Christmas. And now Changing the Guard did that because they were getting off for Christmas break. You saw snow on the ground. You saw him coming home and saying, we're going to eat Christmas dinner. And then at the end, you saw them singing Christmas carols. Nah, that was more, come on, you're crazy, Robert.
Well, what's the difference between 50% Christmas and 20%
and a minute? 1 minute? 1 minute of the damn bin at the end. Come on. All right, but look, I do have one issue with this episode.
It's objective. Let's put it that way.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, they're supposed to be dolls, right? Okay, now, they don't know they're dolls, but they're supposed to be dolls. And they tell the major that they feel no hunger, no thirst, no anything. But when the ballerina falls after their first attempt at climbing to the top, she says she strained her leg, and she was rubbing it. So how could she feel pain? Dolls feel pain? I didn't think that she would feel pain. So I'm assuming, you know what I assumed from that? That this little scene was put in there to throw the viewers off in case we were starting to get a clue about them not being human. Maybe Rod threw that in there. You know, said, well,
kind of like automated and like robots or automatons. Or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he threw it in to look like she had pain, but I don't know how a doll could feel pain. But, and you know, it was a hell for the dolls. It really was. I mean, it was the limbo that the hobo mentioned, and it was a hell until some child gets a hold of them and loves them. And, you know, now none of these five characters.
That sounds familiar. Loves them and holds them.
And loves them, right? Well, none of these characters seemed like they belonged in hell. I mean, they didn't have an evil nature. The clown, he was annoying as hell, but he wasn't evil. You know, they're all just confused, a little scared. And the ending
he
of
liked
it.
Philosophy. I love clowns that sprout philosophy. Why not?
Oh, God.
But, you know, the ending of this episode ranks up there as one of the best surprise twist endings of the entire series. And when I first saw it years ago, I was blown away by the ending. I still love watching it's and the interaction between the major and the clown, that was priceless. I mean, that was terrific. And Murray Matheson, he played the clown. He went on to appear in Twilight Zone, the movie, in 1983. He was in the Kick the Can segment, and he played the old man at the end who decided not to return to old age. He wanted to stay, you know, a kid. And of course, Susan Harrison, she played a beautiful ballerina. She was a beautiful, beautiful woman. And she didn't have much of an acting career, though. She acted for approximately 7 years. She gave it up in 1963 to devote herself to her family. And she occasionally, I read something on IMDb about her. She occasionally appears at film and sci-fi conventions. And Clark Allen, he was the bagpipe player, and he had the least illustrious career. He had 3 acting credits and 1 Broadway role. And the hobo, yeah, he did better. I mean, that was Kelton Garwood, and he appeared in numerous TV series and movies. He died in 1991 at the age of 63. And, of course, we know William Wyndham, he had an incredibly successful career, and he's still around. I think he's 88 now. So, anyway, this episode will always be a favorite of mine. I rank it 5. Classic. So, I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Robert.
Thank you, Lynn.
You're very welcome.
Classic, huh?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Well, you know how I feel about that. This is one of the few that I actually had to do 2 ratings to combine 1 for this episode. And
yeah,
unfortunately, you followed away. I'm going, I ain't giving it a 5, so you can already tell that ahead of time. But, I mean, it was okay for the last 3.5 minutes. Then the first 19 minutes or so, it's boring as crap. I'm sorry, B-O-R-I-N-G, stretching that out. I mean, I like the actors. I thought they did a pretty good job. And, I mean, we talked earlier while Lynn was bringing up the point about them not doing anything and kind of expressing, well, you know, that was something that we didn't see, that this is kind of the aftermath of the major coming into the picture. They didn't do anything. Being this time, being maybe exhausted and not really trying, you know, anymore because they felt it was a useless situation to try to get out of. But, I mean, I'm sorry. I think when he finally clicks, the major does, Wyndham, get the rope together and get ready to do the action to climb out, that is the part where I give it 4 out of 5. I thought that was great. That last 3.5 minutes was, I thought, one of the best parts of this episode. The other 19 minutes, I only give it a 2. I just felt it was very average. See, it comes down to, this is a character piece. And we're trying to get familiar with the characters, trying to build stuff up. And when you do character episodes, there's not that much action. There's not that much going on. We're trying to establish the characters. And the thing is, with the Twilight Zone, and we said it time and time again for the last couple of years, you only got 22 minutes to get all this stuff going.
Exactly.
And it just talk is what it felt like to me. I mean, I had nothing against the characters. If the bagpiper did go into some kind of bagpiping piece, then maybe I felt the same way as Lynn would about him. But we were fortunately escaped that. Actually, didn't anybody think that he kind of reminds you of a James Bond character? Remember one time when James Bond, I think was it the Lazenby one that dressed up in the kilt?
Are you talking about you're talking about Bagpipe Blair?
Yeah.
You know,
didn't he remind you of a James Bond type character? No, who?
Nope. You know, he reminded me of, I even said that to Bobby today. From the side, he looks just like Charlton Heston. I'm not kidding. If you look at him from the side, he looks like Charlton Heston.
So do I.
No, that's true. Bobby does too.
I think on the site, you should put a picture of Charlton Heston and Bobby right next to it so we see the similarities. That's a good idea, Bobby.
That's why she married me.
Yeah. That Charlton Heston fascination, that must be it.
By the way, Felix said that Felix just typed in here the hell reference was scary for him. He didn't like the hell reference while watching it. That was scary for him, and he thought they were dead.
And I agree with Felix. He said it reminded me of the movie Cube. And Felix, I did write that in my review. I did mention the movie Cube. And it's it was a movie. I imagine, Rick, you're familiar with it because it's basically these people sit in a room trying to figure a way out. And then they find out through the movie that it's all just one big giant cube. So, yeah. Good job, Felix. Very much.
But if you
remember that,
you look at that bagpipe player from the side, and I'm serious, he looks just like Charlton Heston.
Okay, I believe you.
Yeah, really. That's right. And Bear Fan Ron said that you remind him of Christmas.
I told him ho 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 back to him.
Oh, that's what the ho ho was. Okay.
That's okay. We'll go on past that there. Anyway, I felt pretty much the story was a precursor to one of my favorite animated movies, and I think with the beginning clues, you could guess which it is, and of course, it's mm-hmm. Toy Story, of course, written by Whedon himself, Buffy, Angel, Firefly, Dollhouse fame, and also the fantastic new Avenger movie that is out. I went and seen it. My wife enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. I thought it was... one of Whedon's great. I also seen the Cabin in the Woods one, and it was pretty good, but not as excited because the Avengers, I mean, that was a great, you know, pairing from the comic books, and mm-hmm. hopefully he'll be back for the sequel to it. We'll just have to wait and see. I hadn't heard any news mm-hmm. on that, but...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there. Unfortunately, in this episode, there wasn't no Woody lines. Like, there's someone poisoned a water hole, there's a snake in my boot, that old Woody would say. However, in certain situations, the toys became alive when they were threatened by the villain of the movie, Sid. And also, the line that Rod says at the end, which I think you mentioned, Lynn,
mm-hmm.
is pretty close to the line that said in the movie, towards the end of the first Toy Story. So it brought up the comment that maybe Whedon might have seen this repeat when he was a kid and maybe was thinking of the same idea. So,
yeah.
To delight people out there, I do have some Toy Story clips.
Awesome.
So here is the official trailer.
Sergeant?
Yes, sir.
Establish a recon post downstairs. Code Red, repeat. We are Code Red. Recon plan, Charlie. Execute. Move.
It's a big one.
Walt Disney Pictures presents a totally new animated motion picture event.
Star Command, come in. Do you read me?
The story of two toys.
There seems to be no sign of intelligent life anywhere.
Hello?
Hoo-yah-bah!
Headed for a showdown.
My name is Woody,
This is my spot.
No!
I am Buzz Lightyear. I come in peace.
You are a child's plaything.
You are a sad, strange little man.
And playing by their own rules.
Draw.
At me again.
I don't like confrontation. Buzz, look, an alien.
Where? You're mocking me, aren't you?
Impressive wingspan. Very good.
Oh, what? What? He can't fly.
Yes, I can.
Can.
This holiday season, the adventure takes off when toys come to life.
To infinity and beyond.
Toy Story.
Look out!
Can.
That's not flying. That's just falling gracefully.
That's great.
If we remember that line.
That is great.
And one of my favorite scenes is, of course, this one coming up with Sid learning a lesson from Woody himself and the toys.
Reach for the sky.
Huh?
This town ain't big enough for the two of us.
What?
Somebody's poisoned the water hole!
It's busted.
Who are you calling busted, Buster? That's right. I'm talking to you, Sid Phillips. We don't like being blown up, Sid. Or smashed, or ripped apart.
We?
That's right. Your toys.
I love that scene where Woody turns his head 360 degrees. That was great. Like The Exorcist or something.
That was good. That was a good movie.
I like that. I think Weenan did a great job on the script for for that. So most definitely. And also, I know, bringing up one of favorite for Lynn, Friday the 13th series, that happened to be, the pilot episode had to be a doll story where they... doing the origin where they're bringing everybody together at the poor Uncle Lewis and what happened to him. Left our reality for his. And that one is about a little girl that gets a haunted doll.
Mm-hmm.
And let me go ahead and play the beginning of that.
He made a deal with the devil to sell cursed antiques, but he broke the pact and it cost him his soul. Now, his niece Mickey and her cousin Ryan have inherited the store, and with it, the curse. Now, they must get everything back, and the real terror begins.
Mom, this is ridiculous. If he had made this immortality pact with the devil, he'd still be alive, wouldn't he?
Unless he tried to get out of it. You don't break a pact with the devil.
Why? Oh, what happened?
Belial? Satan? He wins both ways. In this case, Lewis lost his life. And the antiques remain cursed.
What about the antiques we sold?
Those too, I should think.
The doll.
What doll?
The doll we sold. The doll in the vault.
What are you talking about?
I thought it was my imagination. But that doll turned and stared at me like it was alive.
Oh, wow. Thank you, Daddy.
Mary! Let's not let your mother know about this, okay?
Okay. Can you still talk?
I can still do everything, Mary. And more.
Nothing like having the pilot start with a creepy doll.
Absolutely.
Don't forget the Twilight Zone's own creepy doll talking Tina.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Season 5. Yeah, looking forward to that.
Can't wait to get that's one of Bobby's very favorites, right?
Indeed.
Indeed.
I'm not going to say anything about it now.
Of course.
Yeah. Got to say the best for last when we
right.
get to that point. And one last thing before we head over to Bobby, and I mentioned it in my review, was the movie Dolls.
It looked like a safe haven from the raging storm.
It's an odd kind of place. Where'd your folks get it from, Boris Karloff?
Their hosts seemed like the essence of hospitality.
You can stay here as long as you like.
Wonderful.
But appearances can be very deceiving.
What's the matter? Afraid of the doctor?
Lost? Yeah. Are you scared?
Well, of course not. What's there to be afraid of?
This house?
Oh, don't be. Is that you like toys? I'm a doll maker. I make the most wonderful toys. Dolls, puppets, soldiers, ballerinas. Nobody wants a doll that's special anymore, that's one of a kind. The way that brings out creativity, it helps me in my work.
Dolls. You're never too old to play with dolls. Until you're dead. Dolls.
And Dolls is a very scary thriller movie. And basically the movie is about a toy maker who is in reality a warlock. And where people come across the dolls.
When you called a male witch a warlock.
Well, that's what some people do. What's the
real
determination?
A warlock is a traitor.
Aren't male witches warlocks?
No, I'm a male witch. I am a witch.
Oh, all right, so what are you called? What are you called?
A witch.
Okay.
And but Wicca is the what you practice. Is that correct?
Wicca is what I is my religion, and I am
right,
a witch.
Right, W-I-C-C-A, right. But wait a minute. What does a warlock then?
Yeah, why do they people
warlock
call?
A warlock is a traitor.
Okay. Well, so in Bewitched.
In 1784, a judge called a male witch a warlock, only to differentiate the sexes. There is no differentiation in sexes in Wicca. We are all witches. It is like calling a Christian male a Christian and a Christian female a Christina. There is no such thing, right? There is no such thing in Wicca either.
I did not know that. So Bewitched.
I appreciate that, Rick. I mean, we all like to be educated and corrected on things.
And the sitcom Bewitched is all wrong then, because they always called the male witches warlocks.
Movies are wrong too.
Yeah.
Most of the fiction is wrong, yes.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I'm glad you cleared that up for us. I really am. That's something interesting to know. All right.
Well, I was just going to bring up with the dolls. That's one of the movies that I like just because of the atmosphere and the dolls coming to life in that one. But with my rating, like I said, I had to do two ratings, and I averaged it out to a 3. Out of 5, so
I thought you said 4.5 on the board. In your review, say 4.5.
To the end, the ending.
In the end, okay.
Well, I thought that was
what I said was, if I was breaking this up into two ratings, I would rate the first 19 minutes a 2 out of 5, and the last 3.5 minutes, a 4 out of 5. So I will average this out in a 3 out of 5.
Okay. We'll let you do that. Well, I do.
But I'm at the site and check, and I do have it marked as a 3.
Yeah, so. You do. Yeah. All right.
And I'll go ahead and pass this on over to Bobby. What'd you think, Bobby?
Well, I would say this, that Robert's right. It is boring. It's very boring at the beginning. And that's what I like about it, because any time it can start out boring and end up the way it does, that's something special. And indeed, it reminds me of several other episodes prominently coming to mind, is Eye of the Beholder, another classic episode that really is, when you get right down to it, very boring during the episode. What's fascinating about watching a woman lay in a hospital bed moaning and groaning about her plastic surgery and whether or not it turned out all right? So big deal.
Right.
I mean, you pay your money and take your chances. It's not very fascinating. The only thing fascinating about it is how it ends up and how it turns everything around. The same thing is at work here. It's not terribly interesting watching these characters stand there and whine and carry on and beat the walls and ask where they are and things like this. A little goes a long way with that. However, what I like about this episode is that it's so damned inventive. And again, like I say about a lot of episodes, it just turns everything around at the end. If you do that, if there's a payoff, then it doesn't really matter how boring it is at the beginning. Now, we're coming off 3 consecutive shows in which we talked about episodes that are absolutely dreadful. They were all boring at the beginning, boring in the middle, and they ended up boring. It was just impossible to stay awake. In fact, I didn't stay awake. So here you have something that is, it looks a little tedious at the beginning, just how long is this going to go on? But as it goes on, you get involved. And the main thing you have to do with a story like this is you have to get the audience involved in it. You can't just put that in front of us and say, okay, take a look at these characters and watch them for 23 minutes. Try to get out of here. But as it goes on, you become part of it. It's so claustrophobic that you start to feel a little edgy yourself. Maybe you're in there too. Maybe you don't even realize it. And you can't get out either. And I think that's where the episode really does turn around. The acting is very good. Yes, it is. And some of the characters are very annoying, like the clown and the bagpipe player. But, you know, you put up with all of that because you have a feeling, this uneasy feeling, that it's truly going to go somewhere. You're never sure where.
Right.
Another thing I really enjoyed about the episode is it's very challenging. Now, some Twilight Zone episodes, the really good ones, are indeed like that. They're very challenging. They challenge you to try to figure it out before you get to the end of it. You've been watching the series for some time now, so you know that there's a lot of twist endings, a lot of tricks in it. And so that shouldn't be a big surprise. So after a while, you start to try to beat Rod Serling at his own game. I'll try to figure this out, and there won't be any surprise. At IMDb, 2 people actually claim that they had this pegged from the beginning. I don't know about that. That's easy to say after the fact. Whether they're telling the truth or not, I don't know. But they acted very confident that it was obvious they were dolls. I find it very hard to believe. That certainly wasn't true for me. Another thing I like about the episode is that they start to give things away. Just speaking for myself, I was trying to figure out what was going on here. At first, because there's a light at the top of this cylinder or whatever this is, looking down upon them, I thought they might have been captured by aliens and they were under a microscope being studied. But then I believe it's the clown that says, perhaps we're under a microscope. So that takes care of that. You know you're wrong on that because they wouldn't give it away if that was the case. So that's gone. And then I figured since this is Twilight Zone, perhaps they were captured by aliens and they're just being studied that way and they're on their way to another planet. But then the ballerina says, I think we're on a spaceship and we're headed to another planet. That took care of that. So you're watching the story and you're thinking to yourself, that's fine. All the ideas I had in my mind are going down the drain. I really like that idea. It takes a lot of chutzpah to give those things out and still try to throw people off while you're trying to figure out what is going on. So I really enjoyed that part of it. One of the main things I really like about this episode is the way it looks. In this case, rare for the Twilight Zone, the chintzy behavior of CBS and not giving Rod Serling any money to do anything with and not be able to create any special effects or do any scenic design that means anything actually helps this episode. It should be like this. It should be as plain and nondescript as can be because it's a lot more frightening that way. There's just nothing around. You're just stuck and can only walk around the cylinder endlessly and never get out. So that really helped it. My favorite scene in the episode, I agree with Robert, it's that last section there. But what I really admire is the unusual camera angle that they had to use. They're showing all of these characters standing on top of each other on their shoulders. And it really is very realistic. It looks like they're really standing there. We all know that they're all laying down on the floor pretending to be standing on each other, and they simply have the camera down there on the floor. I've never seen that before, and it really is very impressive. I like that. And I wouldn't want to be one of those actors, because if you're doing that and your director's telling you, listen, nobody's standing on your shoulders, but you got to pretend that they are. So they're all grimacing, and their shoulders are going up and down. It looks like they're going to collapse at any moment. That takes some ability. It's not that easy to do that. You have to really work at that kind of thing, I would imagine. So I really like that unusual camera angle. It's really, really very, very different. At the beginning of the episode, when Rod Serling does his little piece, that's unusual because usually he's standing off on the side somewhere, and he comes into camera range, and he says what he has to say. In this case, he's actually looking down into this thing. And it appears that he's looking down, and it's almost a giveaway. Like, what is he looking down into? What is that all about? So if you're paying enough attention, you might wonder, wait a minute, how can he be looking down these characters? They couldn't really be as big as we think they are. He wouldn't be able to be looking at them that way. So they must be really small. I guess you could take it from there, somehow figure out they were dolls or something like that. I'm not really sure about that. But there's what I like about it is just that a lot of things are just given away. And you still can't figure it out because I was, like everybody else, completely fooled at the very end. Now, the other thing about it is inanimate objects, dolls or whatever, do they really have any feelings? How do we know they don't have any feelings? I mean, they were created by humans. They were made by humans. And maybe we invest some feeling in them that we're not aware of. So I have a little story to tell, and this is a true story. When I was very, very small, about maybe 5 or 6 years old, my older sister had, like a lot of girls at that time, had dolls. She had two dolls that meant a lot to her. And these weren't just the kind of dolls you see today. They were not made out of plastic. I'm not sure exactly. I don't remember exactly what they were made out of. Probably ceramic or something.
Porcelain,
yeah. They were very...
Papier-mâché?
Not really. They were very, very realistic. And when I say very realistic, I mean it. I mean, their faces were very expressive. These weren't Barbie dolls or anything. They were very expressive, especially their eyes. And they had long eyelashes on them like some humans do. When you pick them up, their eyes opened and closed. And they appeared to be looking at you. I was impressed. I mean, as a boy, I wasn't interested in dolls, but I was impressed by that. Now, my sister treated them as if they were real and had real feelings. I mean, she was really serious about it. And, of course, as you might imagine, she wouldn't let me touch them at all, get around them at all. But when she told me to stay away from them and not be near them, she didn't say, you can't touch them because you might break them. She said, you might hurt them, which is a different story than saying you might break them. She actually treated them as if they had feelings. And after a while, being such a small child, I thought to myself, that's unusual. I didn't think that things that weren't human had feelings. I actually started to think in my own mind, maybe she's right. Maybe they do have feelings. So I stayed away from them. So I think that was unusual because most people would say, you know, you don't break it or you're going to break it. She never used that word at all. She always said, you're going to hurt them. And that made them seem to me like they were very real. They looked very real, and she treated them that were very real. So this episode always reminds me of that time when I was a little boy, and I had to wonder whether or not my sister knew what she was talking about. It's very unusual. So this.
Well, you were a smart kid, Bobby, because some kids would just sneak in there and do something they shouldn't be doing anyway. So.
What do you mean? You mean touch them anyway? No, she'd have killed me.
Yeah, play with them, go in and play with them.
That's
or
why
might
I'm
break
still alive
them or
today,
something
because
like
I didn't do that. She wasn't kidding around. And these dolls, if I remember correctly, were not bought in the store. They were handed down from another generation. They were that old. And,
I should have touched them, yeah.
Yeah, they were probably porcelain then if they were handed down from generation.
Yeah, it was really quite amazing. And they had, their eyes especially were extremely expressive. I mean, it was really remarkable. If you held them up in front of you, they looked like they were looking right at you. And it was very, 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 very odd. So this episode really always reminds me of that. I agree. I gave it a 5. I think it's a classic episode. I don't know that I would put it in the Twilight Zone Hall of Fame. I wouldn't go that far with it. But there are episodes. There are 5 on our rating scale. 5 is a classic episode, and I agree it's a classic episode, but I wouldn't go too far as that is concerned, because I have to agree with Robert. There are aspects of it that just kind of are a little tedious. I know one thing. Had this thing gone on, had been in the hour-long season, it would have been impossible to watch.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It would have been unbearable to hear all that whining and to hear the clown, which makes me want to climb the walls myself.
Yeah, this would not have worked as an hour-long episode.
Oh, no. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I don't think much of anything works as an hour-long episode. Absolutely hate it.
I don't think this.
As a matter of fact, for people who have MeTV on their cable system, and they show the Twilight Zone every night at 11 o'clock, at least our time, and they're right now in the hour-long season, and every night Lynn asks me, which one is on tonight? And I go, forget it. You don't want to watch this piece of junk. I mean, I just think.
Yeah, my wife brought that up. So, yeah, I told her, we're in season four on there. So, like, there's only one good show from season four that I would rate a 5 out of 5. But you'll have to wait to get what I tell you.
Oh, really? Well, there's only one that I like, and I'll tell you right now what it was. And that's the one with Adolf Hitler in it, where the street guys is turning into Adolf Hitler. I like that episode. I think that's pretty good. I have no idea what you would give a 5. I probably won't agree with it, but that's...
Wait a minute. What about Thursday to Leave for Home?
That's okay, but I wouldn't give it a 5.
It's okay?
Yeah.
Oh, come on. Thursday to Leave for... Oh, good Lord.
Cancel a move.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other one that I like, that was an hour-long episode, and maybe I wouldn't give it a 5, but... The one with Martin Balsam about the wax figures.
Oh, yeah, that one.
Man, that was a scary
episode. It reminded me of another story from a series that had a same, similar situation
That was a frightening episode. That was a frightening episode, and I may not give it a 5, but I thought that was really, really a good episode, and
Well, not to get off on a tangent about this since we're not up to that point, but
right.
The worst part about this season is that the series is winding down and it shows its wear. And then you have to have that dreadful season 5 where there are some really classic episodes. But boy, when you get to the end of the series, that is really dreadful.
Yeah.
And all I'm looking forward to is reviewing Come Wonder With Me because I know that's the one that didn't want to do
the most. The one I'm looking forward to review is Jezebel.
I believe that was on just about a week ago. I think it was on there last week.
Yep.
And I tried desperately to avoid it. Anyway, getting back to this, it is an inventive episode. And that, you know, I say that all the time about Twilight Zone because today, in 2012, it's just TV is so bad. Somebody puts a show on, and within 2 weeks, there's 12 more of them on, and they all look the same. So I always appreciate when there's something new and something different that doesn't look like anything else. And this is one of those episodes that you can certainly say that about. It's really good. And like I said, I like the unusual camera angle and that kind of stuff. And you do get involved after a while. And considering that's only about a 23-minute story, you feel after a while as if you're there. One other thing that Lynn mentioned, and that's I like the ending very much. It's a nice ending. And I'm not talking about the fact that they're dolls. That's surprising. But I like the ending when you show the ballerina taking her hand and putting it on the major's hand, and she's got tears in her eyes. That's a very nice touch.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that was in the original story or whether Rod Serling added that when he adapted it for TV, but that was a very nice touch. So it's one of those feel-good episodes because it ends and you're told that, they were discarded, but they'll be loved again by children who really need them, and that makes everybody feel good. So... I'll give it a 5, not a Hall of Fame, but it gets a 5 from me. Lynn?
Okay.
Lynn, that brings up that episode of Amazing Stories where you guys expressed about the hands touching. Remember the episode with John Lithgow, who turns into a doll?
Because he's fascinated
with that one.
God,
yeah, and then towards the end.
Oh, my God.
And towards the end, they hold hands. Yeah.
I forgot all about that Amazing Stories. Steven Spielberg, that was really a good series. I was disappointed when they canceled that. I really was. But
I used to watch it.
Yeah, I did too. I was disappointed when they canceled it. I thought it was good. Okay, well, Dave.
Okay, well, I haven't got a great deal to say about the episode because without giving any secrets away to the listeners listening to the recording, I wasn't quite sure we were doing things tonight. But there you go.
it's a whole mystery day behind us.
I have seen it in the past, and I will just And I will comment about the actual episode in a moment. But yes, this reminded me of a few other stories. In fact, a couple of other Twilight Zone episodes. Of course, it reminds me of the one from season one. That's episode 34, The After Hours. The girl who goes into the shop to buy a present. And it turns out that she has to go up to the top floor where all the mannequins are. We've already done that episode, so I don't think it's a spoiler. Anybody who's listened to the previous Talking Twilight episodes will know how we covered that one. Another one was in Series 2, Episode 44, The Lateness of the Hour, where a young girl's with a family and her father, and they seem very keen on robots.
Mm-hmm. She's a robot, all right.
Okay. All right, it's out there. But the whole point although they weren't dolls, it had that similar vibe to me in a way. I mean, all right, it wasn't a question of not knowing where they were, but they didn't know who they were or what they were. They didn't have that awareness. And, of course, that reminds me, in this idea has been used before, not necessarily the dolls theme, but the idea of people, you know, it starts with people, waking up and not knowing who or what or why or where they are. I'm sure Robert will remember the Buffy episode. I think it's called Tabula Rasa, or Rosa.
Tabula Rosa. Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. This is Tabula where Rosa. They're in a magic shop and a spell that's cast, which is supposed to make one of them lose a bad memory, means they all lose a memory. But they all wake up in the shop, and then from the clues in the shop, they're trying to find out, who is which. And it involves some very amusing things, because if you know the characters from Buffy, one of them is a vampire called Spike, and he has an English accent, as does Buffy's watcher, Giles, who has an English accent. So they assume that they're father and son, and because they're in the magic shop, they assume that they enjoy, together, Spike looks inside his coat because he's a vampire. He'd stolen this coat or something, and he finds out his name's called Randy, and he's upset with his dad for why do you give me a stupid name like Randy? And of course Buffy doesn't know that she's got powers. So the whole point is, although they're not trying to get out, they're actually trying to find out what the situation is. Another one again. Posting this more towards Robert, there's a very early Doctor Who from the classic series with the second Doctor, Jamie and Zoe, called the Mind Robber, and they end up not so much not knowing things, but they end up in like a toy land, and they have a series of things.
Or what about Night Terror that just aired not too long ago?
Right, indeed, yep. Yes, from the newer series, yeah. And there was one other one. Where has it gone? Oh, yes, the movie, Night at the Museum. That's got a similar idea, although, again, they've not lost the memories, but you have this situation where they come to life when human beings aren't around. Of course, that's been used lots of times in other things. So, going back to the actual episode, my memory's not that fresh about it, but I do remember the reveal being pretty good. I think you could guess it a little bit before, because you were either in the Oval Office or you had these very curved walls, I seem to remember, which sort of made it an unusual thing. Of course, that led to the speculation that they were in some sort of captivity, and I agree with Bobby, although it was actually expressed, once it's expressed by the cast, you assume it can't be the exact answer. But, you have this feeling as though they might be in a land of giants or something on that part. What else? Not really a great deal from me this time, but, of course, William Wyndon, is it, who played the...
Wyndham, yeah.
Most amazing thing I've read about him, he had five wives. My five sons.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. So that's quite. And of course, more than Robert, people in the room, I remember him from playing Commodore Decker in a Star Trek episode called The Doomsday Machine.
Oh, yeah, The Doomsday Machine. Yep.
Yep.
Where he played this absolutely obsessed captain, brilliantly played it, and you know, that was something that I really remember.
Closing fast.
Helmsman, hold your course. Stand by all phaser banks.
Aye, aye, sir.
Of course, if you look at his bibliography, he's been in absolutely everything from Fugitive to Invaders to Mission Impossible. I mean, he was a career actor on TV, Streets of San Francisco, and
right.
all sorts
and
of
also
things.
And remember the Farmer's Daughter with Inger Stevens, another Twilight Zone alumni, Inger Stevens.
Right.
Yeah,
he was also
Farmer's
in the other end of the scale. He was in Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. So he's done it all.
God, I didn't know that.
So really, I am skating around with little bits and pieces of information because my recollection of the episode is rather hazy. But I've got a feeling that I would agree exactly with what's been said in the room if I rewatched it. I'd be sort of fast-forwarding it through the first 15 minutes, probably for the denouement and the last 5 minutes. So I'm going to give it a middle-of-the-road rating of 3, and that is a rating given on memory only.
Okay. And Rick?
Yep.
Get
right. in there so you can get your hellhound going there.
Yep.
That's right. You got your hellhound on the walk. Yeah.
Anywho, I don't know. For some reason, I used to love this episode. I saw it recently, and I don't know. I was kind of bored by it. I don't know. Maybe it was the mood I was in when I was watching. And I'm one who happens to like character development episodes and stuff. I don't know. Like I said, I became very bored with it. Which is unusual.
But you used to like it. You used to like it, huh?
Yeah. Maybe I've seen it too much. I don't know.
Well, rewatched it wasn't there for you with this episode, then, Rick?
Yeah, maybe. You know, like I said 2 weeks ago, I'm one to talk because nothing really happens in Harrow House. Well, it does, but it's hard to explain. Anywho. No, nothing wrong with the acting and stuff. I just, like I said, you know, maybe I've seen it too much. Maybe I wasn't in the right mood for it the last time. I don't know. I'd still give it a 4 just because of the acting.
Yeah. Yeah, the acting was very good on everybody's part, I think. Definitely was great acting. So you give it a 4, okay. And Ed, how about you?
Okay. Well, before I start, I just want to say, this is aimed at Robert, who played the clips. Just want to say I donate all creepy talking dolls and other cursed items to Goodwill. So I've never been cursed, thankfully. The frugal shoppers at Goodwill, well, they're on their own. Anyway, Robert, by the way, I love the Toy Story tie-in. That was a lot of fun.
All right, good night. Guys,
that was great. I love the clips you had there.
Night, Rick, and thanks. We'll go ahead and I'll check on that. Go ahead and have that one re-listen. And I'll re-listen to for it. Okay.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
No problem.
All right.
Bye, Rick.
And we'll get back to Ed here, our friend today in the Talking Twilight Zone show here. Go ahead, Ed. I didn't mean to interrupt you there.
That's okay. Don't worry.
Yeah, Rick was leaving. Rick's leaving to walk his dog, who he calls
right,
the hellhound.
Yeah, have a good walk.
It's his friend.
Have a good walkabout. All right.
It's his friend.
Do you mean that was a dog in search of an exit?
That's right.
Yeah, his friend. Rick and the hellhound walking away into the distance.
Go ahead, Ed.
All right. So as for my opinion on this episode, I got to tell you that I loved it. I saw this first when I was about 9 years old in syndication, and I can tell you that the ending genuinely spooked me. I saw it a few years ago again and loved it, and I saw it last week again, and I still love it. I love the dialogue. It it, you know, bored some people, I guess, but I thought it built the situation. By the way, Lynn, you said the bagpipes would be torture to you. Some would consider being locked in a cylinder with a clown for a seemingly endless time a nightmare in itself. So, no.
And he was annoying, wasn't he?
He was annoying, but Murray Matheson, who played this clown, he was genuinely annoying, you know, the living crud out of the major. But the he gets my personal nomination for the best actor in this episode. He nailed it. He was funny at times.
Yeah.
He was likable in his own weird way with his sharp sarcasm, but I loved his performance. The character was annoying, but as an actor, he did a great job with it.
I agree with that, especially at the end when he's just standing there looking up at the top of after the guy falls over, you know, after the major falls over, and he says, a very brave man, you know, not a very bright one.
Exactly.
You know, and he just has...
And that coming from a clown.
Exactly. And he just got like this totally...
With a flower on his head. That's very bright.
Exactly. And he has like this totally emotional feeling, you know, looking up, and he's like, not, you know, very brave man, but not a very bright one. I'm like, oh, you know, this guy has feelings, you know, he has emotions.
Yeah, exactly. And the major played by William Wyndham, he did a great job with this. His frustration just bleeds through the screen. He's getting, you know, his claustrophobia builds up, you know. He's an exceptional actor. He really did a great job with this. I mean, at the time, you think about some of the actors that were in other episodes that were really lacking. I thought he was great for the part. And then the complacency of the others around them, you know, they're just like, oh, whatever, we've been here for a long time, we've given up, you know, the bagpiper, which is Clark Allen, says, this is the universe here, you know, they just given up to the fact that this is where they are, this is where they're going to live, and it's in contrast to the major, who's just going nuts, I mean, he's dying, he wants to get out of this place, you know, no matter what,
banging on the wall and everything, again,
he's banging on the walls, yeah, and they're saying, well, we've tried this before, we've been in here for a long, long time, you know, and you get the sense that, you know, the characters, the toys that we find out they are in the end, they have a different sense of time, obviously, an endless time to them is probably a morning inside of a bin, you know, but they do an awesome job of building, now, a puzzling situation through, you know, the interactions of the character, and the sheer simplicity of the, you know, the situation and the set they used, you know, a very simple, you know, a cylinder.
Oh, it couldn't have been plainer. I mean, they couldn't have, I mean, you're going to talk about cutting costs. I mean, they couldn't have gotten any cheaper than what they did for that episode.
Right, but it worked so well for this, you know.
Exactly.
You know, you didn't know what it was until the very end, and it could be anywhere. It could be Limbo, or as the major says, it's hell, you know, or it could be a dungeon, like the ballerina says, and it really leaves you guessing until that final, you know, powerful moment at the end where you finally see that they're all dolls in the donation bin, and the situation, you know, becomes crystal clear. The mannequins, by the way, the mannequins they had at the end, I love those mannequins. That was a neat thing to add at the very end that, you know, gave you the clear picture of what they are. You know, they're not people.
Yeah.
They're just toys. And the fact that they crafted them to look like the actors and not just generic, you know, toy faces, that's what really made the ending great.
Wasn't
for me.
Wasn't that great? Yeah.
Yeah. And the tear on the ballerina's eye at the end, that was fantastic.
That
just
was
for me,
priceless.
It was great. I mean, for me, the ending makes this a strong five. I love this episode.
It was really good. Yeah. I mean, when you saw the hand go down over the major's hand and then the tear, oh my God, that couldn't have been more, you know, emotional right there. I mean, that was perfect. Absolutely perfect.
I love it.
So, okay, it looks like you gave it a five, right?
Right, a five, yep.
Okay, so we've got a four, Rick gave it, and three fives. Okay, so that's awesome. That's awesome. Well, at least it is a good enough episode that nobody trashed it. And Bear Fan Ron gives it a 4.5. And
Felix gave 1.2.
Felix gives it a 4. Yep. Felix gives it a 4. Yeah. So we're doing pretty good with this one. This is a great episode. And
episode did pretty good, Lynn. Over at the side here, it went 3, 4, 4.5, and 5. There was nothing below 3. So it did very well.
Yeah, absolutely. And then our next episode on the 23rd. Oh, God. Quality of Mercy. Oh, God. Tell me I don't have to. I might be
you
sick
sound,
that day.
You sound strained.
I may have to be sick that day.
It's not strange.
Well,
oh, damn it.
For that, we'll have to give her a little
pearls,
music.
Pearls before swine.
Oy vey.
All right, okay. The 23rd, 2 weeks from now, on the 23rd, we're going to be reviewing Equality of Mercy with Dean Stockwell. And, yeah, okay. Not quite the
not like there's any prejudice in that episode.
No,
huh?
No. You didn't get anything from my tone of voice, did you? No.
We get to see Spock without the eyebrows.
Yeah. There you go.
If Dean Stockwell's in it, Robert, I'm expecting at least one Quantum Leap.
Quantum Leap. Yeah, I was thinking that too. So.
Yeah.
And I got ahead and typed in the chat our website at the Twilight Zone Hall of Fame. It does work, so I just tried it out. And from there, you can also get to the Yahoo site as well. So when you get there, and if you want to check out the Yahoo site, just click on the revisited site,
and
it'll take you right there.
I have to add reviews to it, which I got sidetracked when we found out that we were going to be moving back to Pennsylvania. So I've been really busy, and I haven't had a chance to go back on the site, but I can do that this week because we're getting things together here. So,
but our reviews is on Once Upon a Time, because I tried that one and it did work. So if you want to download our reviews, just while you listen to Once Upon a Time, you can click on the downloaded documents there.
Right.
And you can read our reviews.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Well, the 23rd, 2 weeks from now, June 23rd, we will be reviewing Equality of Mercy. And I do hope to see everybody. I'm glad we had a full house today. Look at all the people here. This is wonderful.
I know. Wow. It's great.
Oh, and hi, Parker. I'm sorry that I didn't say hi to you and guest five as well. But I'm just glad that everyone's here. And hopefully we'll see you in 2 weeks. And we'll be back to have another fun discussion. What a quality of mercy.
I love how you put that, fun discussion.
Yeah, fun discussion.
And just to remind people, the Quality of Mercy was also used in the Twilight Zone, the movie, the very beginning with
that's
Dick Morrell.
Right.
So
yes, it was.
That's something we'll talk about, too.
Yeah, they called it something different, but
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And poor Vic Morrow died during the filming of that.
Oh,
very sad.
Yep, very tragic.
Him and two children.
The helicopter crashed
into them. Yeah.
Right.
It crashed into them, the two children and Vic Morrow. They all three of them died during that. And what's amazing to me, that episode was a complete episode. I mean, they filmed it from beginning to end, and you know, I always wondered, he died during the filming of it, so somehow I guess, Rick's not here right now, but I was going to say that sometimes I guess they shoot endings of shows before beginnings or middles, but he was there for the whole episode from beginning to end, and even though he died during it, the whole episode
it did go to trial, but nobody was really held responsible
right.
for the accident,
exactly.
So yeah, that's what it was ruled, accident.
Yeah, but, and he made it through the whole episode, showed him, so I don't know how I guess they managed to get it all done before he got killed. But anyway, all right, so enough of that morbid stuff. And we'll be back in 2 weeks. And I hope to see everyone here. So have a terrific rest of the weekend, folks.
All right, guys, have a good one.
Okay. Talk
to you
soon. Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
And before we do the outro, let's play a little Manhattan Transfer and their version of Twilight Zone. From 1979.
Ooh, I never heard that.
See y'all next time.
Okay.